This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A multi-year journey of daily writing taught Alexis Pauline Gums a lot about what it means to listen. She's an author and a poet and a scholar whose daily writing practice changed the way she thinks about the stories that define humanity, the stories that she knew and stories that she knew about her own ancestry. It even changed her definition of who her ancestors are to include members of other species. She writes about it in the concluding book of her poetic trilogy. The book is called Dub, Finding Ceremony. Alexis Pauline Gums joins me in the studio now. Welcome back.
I'm so happy to be here.
It's great to have you. All of the volumes of this trilogy are influenced by Black feminist writers. So talk about the arc of the trilogy first, and then we'll get to Dub.
Sure. So all three of these theorists are people who are living and theorizing right now, which is exciting. And they are the people who I found myself citing and quoting again and again and again, probably to the disdain of even my teachers and dissertation committee while I was in graduate school. But there was something so compelling about each of them. And so when I was making my decisions about what do I want my intellectual writing to be like, I realized that there was something about all three of these theorists that was exciting to me in the content of what they said, but also in the forms that they used, because none of them took the traditional route of writing what they call an academic monograph based on whatever dissertation they had written. And I was in that same place. So I decided to start this daily practice. And the three theorists are Hortense Spillers, M. Jackie Alexander, and then this is finally Sylvia Winter.
And is that the through line, the fact that they sort of exploded the form and came up with a new way, particularly to sort of make more relevant and accessible their theories, which are deep and complex, but not confined to the academy?
Yes, I think it had to do with their accountability. So Sylvia Winter, her essays have not even all been collected. Well, none of them have been collected yet. So some of them are in different anthologies, some of them are in different journals, but they're all these instances where she was speaking to a particular audience fervently. And though she has across her body of work this core argument about what it is to be human and transforming those ideas, the way that she says it based on who she's talking to in this particular instance is everything. And so I think about myself in that way too. I'm not theorizing, I'm not writing to prove that I'm smart in a vacuum. I'm actually really invested in the communities that I hope can be in conversation with me.
Tell us about Sylvia Winter's theories about humanity, because they are particular to this time and place, right? And how this time and place and our recent history has shaped those ideas.
Yes. So Sylvia Winter is a genius. She is somebody who, I write about it in my introduction, she learned all the languages of colonialism. And she really wanted to look back and do an intellectual history, think about history of science and history of thought, to ask this question: what made it understandable? What made it seem rational to do the most horrific things you can imagine, which we would call, if we were to sum them up, colonialism and slavery? What could actually make someone think that that made sense, when the level of violence actually tears sense apart? And this has been the major project of her life, is not only to say, okay, how did this come about, but to say, since it came about in a particular and specific way, we could actually create another form of sense. We could actually be in relationship with our environment and each other in a way that does not reproduce those forms of violence.
Well, and tell us more about that theory that, you know, over the past 500 years, that hand in hand with capitalism, colonialism, white supremacy, all of which are necessary to each other, there is a new understanding of what it means to be human.
Yes. And so Sylvia Winter would say homo economicus. She would say that there's this understanding of being human that actually is an economic unit of relation. So what it is to actually be a person has to do with your relationship to capital, not your relationship to your mother or any other people who are in community with you, but actually your relationship to a system called capital, which measures whether you're actually a person or not, which she says that's the new religion. So she says there's a way that, and she's one of the most incredible historians of science, that there's a merge between this understanding that we are purely scientific organisms that feeds into us having a primary relationship with capitalism, and then feeling like it's natural.
You're right.
Saying like that's the natural thing for us to do.
Natural and 'twas ever thus. This is the way we've always thought about ourselves in this kind of hierarchy, whereas it gave us permission to thingify, as Dr. King said, to thingify humans and to thingify the entire natural world. And you write about, and I think enter deeply into, and we'll start talking more about that, a relationship with the natural world that was utterly broken by the imperialist capitalist movement that said, no, we can own it, we can break it, we can rebuild it in our own image and likeness.
That's right. Yeah, an understanding of domination, right, and not being in relation. And so Sylvia Winter points out that actually that's a very specific approach, that you have groups of people all over the world who are in relationship with their environment in different ways. One group chose a form of domination and then included all the rest of the people in that idea of nature and dominated them too, right? That is a very short way of saying something that she elaborates.
Right. Go ahead, finish that thought.
And so I think that where her work has taken me is to this place of, well, what is my relationship? What is my relationship with the creatures in the ocean? What is my relationship with the water that I'm accessing? And how would I even think about it or describe it if it wasn't all mediated by capital?
So take us into that process, this new way of engaging those questions, asking the questions, and finding the answers.
Well, what my actual writing process has been, and this is the case for all three of these books, is really being with the work of the theorist. So being with Sylvia Winter's work, and she's an argumentative person, right? She's making this argument. She wants us to know that something else is possible, and she's speaking to people. So there's these different points of emphasis that ended up guiding me. Like, where does the word show up italicized or double underlined or in bold? Because that's the place where she's leaning in and saying, like, we can do this differently. And so I actually made myself more than a year's worth of daily writing prompts based on those places, and then kind of let go and trusted where it took me. And so it took me into my own relationships. It took me into my relationships with my family. It took me into a process where I was like, okay, I'm listening to my ancestors, because just like the Enlightenment is almost like the story that we have inherited in our society about what it means to be human, my stories about what it means to be this particular human are inherited by, well, what do I think a Black person is? What is a Black woman? What does it mean to be of Caribbean ancestry? Those are those stories, but I can unlearn and relearn those stories as well.
How much unlearning has to be done? Because to be a Black woman, you have to have been defined by white supremacy, right? I mean, that there is no Black woman before there's this colonial movement.
Well, and this is exactly why Sylvia Winter's work is so exciting, because she's saying what is before that? Like, what is the poetic reach is actually to describe what can't be described in this language, right? So I have to use these terms that I only need to use because I'm navigating this culture and I'm pushing back against a language. You know, they say the English language especially is a language of capitalism, right? And so I'm actually reaching to say something that is impossible to say. It exceeds the values of the culture that I'm living inside of, and therefore it's poetic. Sylvia Winter has this beautiful essay called Ethnopoetics or Sociopoetics, and she says what the poetic is this process of trying to say what we can't say, trying to say a different relationship that capitalism has made impossible to say.
Is this somewhat like in the Divine Comedy, where we have Virgil, right, the intellectual, the intellectual and ancient guide for 2/3 of the work? You have to start there on that side of the brain with that particular guide, and then shed that guide so that you can finally work into a different form of mind to get the last bit of the way.
Yeah, it is like that. It's like, I mean, I've been studying marine mammals now, but it's thinking about what is it that happens when you dive and you are holding your breath, and there's a particular point where you have to acclimate yourself to the environment that you're in now, right? Like you get to a certain level of depth where what works for you on land is not what's going to work with you at this level of immersion. It is like that. So I think that Sylvia Winter is, I mean, what she does in terms of her incredible facility with these multiple languages of colonialism is say, okay, take it all the way. Take it all the way to what it says its own origin is. And that's the place where we get to create another ceremony. And I think it's important that Sylvia Winter is a theorist, but she also is a playwright. She also has written a novel. She also is continually involved in collective art making process with her communities, because she's saying, well, we get to now create what is going to be the origin from now. And she's especially excited about this time where everyone on the planet can communicate with each other at the same time. You know, we're interconnected in this particular way, which was not the case. There was an imposed universalism that was a lie for all of these years. But now we actually can make decisions as a species. What would it mean if we made a different set
of
decisions?
We have to re-examine now the language and the structures that have been created so that if when we get into the creative process, we don't replicate and reproduce the same madness that we've had. Can I ask you to read one of your works for us?
Absolutely. So this is from early on, and it's kind of what happened in this process is I'm listening for my ancestors, and then I kind of trip out about who are my ancestors actually. If you gathered them, they would be everyone. Gather them. Recognize in them your jawline, your wet eyes, your long-fingered hands seeking what but this multitude. If you gathered them, they would not fit on this island. They would spill back into the ocean whence they came. When you gather them, they will have fins and claws and names you do not know. Gather them anyway. Some will look you in the eye. Some are too microscopic to see. If you don't gather them all, you will never be free. If you gathered them, you could not hold them, scold them, demand back what you think is lost. Gather them today, or your soul is the cost. Gather the ones who sold and who bought and who tossed overboard. Gather the erstwhile children in the name of the Lord. Gather the unclaimed fathers, the ones with guns and with swords. Gather them up with your hands. With your relationship to land, with your chin set, you are not done yet. You never will. Gather them more. Gather them still. They will unfound you and surround you, unfind you and unwind you, travel to you, unravel through your own needle. Gather the thread. Collect your dead.
Alexis Pauline Gumbs from Dub Finding Ceremony. Talk more about that. I love this idea of unwinding and unfinding. I mean, that's what you were talking about earlier, right? You have to make this journey to get to this place. And you had a breakthrough, a moment, listening for Boda, one of your ancestral mothers. Talk about that moment and who Boda is.
Boda is the name of one of my ancestral mothers who survived the Middle Passage. And she was an enslaved person in Anguilla. Her memory has been kept. Anguilla is a small island and has a powerful oral history. And people have been named after Boda. It's known that she is almost like our connection to Africa. So I learned her name from one of the elders in my family, Hudson Gumbs, years ago. And it was just kind of there with me. Like, that's the name. That's the name. And then I would forget the name and ask him again. And, you know, it wasn't something that I didn't feel like I was in relationship with her. It was like a fact, you know, that I knew that was part of our story. And then I started having these dreams. And it's a longer story, but I was at a dream retreat. And recent State of Things guest, Maya Freeland, was there too. And I started having all these dreams that were, what they had in common was they were like wedding dreams. Like, people were getting married, people were wearing wedding attire, which a whole nother episode is that I'm a marriage abolitionist, so that's not even really my dream in any form of the word. But I was doing a writing activity during that retreat, and Alma, who facilitated it, said, choose the name of the character. And immediately it was Boda. And then I was like, oh, Boda. So for me, when I hear Boda, Boda was an Ashanti woman, speaker of languages that I have not learned yet, but boda in Spanish means wedding. And so I was having all these dreams of weddings, and I was like, oh, what if it's her? What if there's a way of thinking about this person as someone who can teach me something through my dreams? What would it be to say boda, which in Twi, which would have been a language from her area, is a form of yellow coral? What if it's my relationship with the ocean? What if it's a union with her across the ocean, not a marriage in the patriarchal sense, but some kind of way for us to be back together? So I started doing research about Akan cosmology, which is the religious framework of the area that she would have been from, and thinking about what plants were there in that area. Were there any of the same plants in Anguilla? What might it be like for her to be who she was across this huge divide that we're supposed to understand has completely broken everything, where there is no way to actually travel back across it? But then, in a way, through my relationship, my ancestral relationship to her, can I do some of that work? Can I speculate in ways that teach me something relevant for what it is to be alive now?
So that goes beyond then and much deeper than just a deeper human connection broken by the racial hierarchies critical to imperialism and capitalism, colonialism, that humanity is bound together. Now you're bound more closely with the natural world, which mm-hmm. got you thinking much more deeply about ecology and the importance of things like climate change.
Absolutely. And in Akan cosmology, that one of the praise names of God is Totoro Bonsu, which we would think of as like the huge, powerful being in the ocean. I think that's a whale from my perspective now. But that's one of those energies that it talks about the power of water, but it also talks about the power of being and this triumphant form of being. And what would it be like to be in the ocean on a ship as a captive in this belly of a boat, knowing that these are the same ships, these enslaving ships were the same whaling ships that were actually hunting for whales, and to be kin in a particular way. And I've been thinking about what is it? What is it to be submerged? And what do we have to learn from whales, especially because we're mammals too, and the ocean is rising because of us, and that there's something about a depth of breathing that I think has to do with connecting to that broad collective experience of the Middle Passage, which also is a relationship with everyone else in the ocean.
Do you, and you've been doing this as a writing exercise, so these are the kinds of thoughts that you engage in daily.
Mm-hmm.
They end up in some form of writing. Through that process, you know, you use the word thinking over, and I was thinking about, does that thought process change? Can you feel a connection other than, I can imagine you say those things, and I can imagine what that might be like.
Right.
But if I spent time with it, I suspect that even my somatic experience of what I'm thinking about would change the way I feel. Does that happen to you?
It does. Yeah, I do think it's a somatic experience. It's very much an embodied experience. And when I start to think about breathing, for example, and part of the way rhythm functions also in the book is that there's something for this listening, I had to learn something about breathing differently. And what is the form of breathing? What is the form of breathing that existed in the transatlantic Middle Passage? How is it different from the form of breathing of a Pilates class in Durham in 2020? You know, like, what's similar about it too? And how we experience these things through our bodies. So I think that these ceremonies in the book, even to edit them, and to copy edit them, you know, I find myself in tears. You know, I find my heart racing. I find myself breathing into different places in my body because they're not just telling me something, right? They're an invitation for an energy shift to happen.
In connection with ancestors and even the broader world. Alexis, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Come back soon. Alexis Pauline Gums, poet, scholar, author, her latest book called Dub, Finding Ceremony. She's going to be at a book signing tonight at Golden Fig Bookstore in Durham. That's at 7 o'clock. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org.